एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
So myself, Rishabh, I am the co-founder and CEO of CreateGenics, and which is primarily addressing the rising NPA issue in the developing economies.
We've all heard of young mavericks like Mark Zuckerberg, who were running companies worth millions of dollars while still in their 20s. But what does it take to become such a successful young entrepreneur? Akshay Dutt is on a mission to learn this by talking to one such young gun, Rishabh Goel. Rishabh is the founder of CreateGenics, which is in the vertical SaaS space. A vertical SaaS company is one that focuses on providing a software solution for a deep niche. And CreateGenics has created the market for SaaS for loan collections. They help companies collect bad debts more effectively and directly impact the bottom line of banks, NBFCs, fintechs, and collection agencies. Listen to this fascinating journey of how Rishabh built up a company worth more than $100 million in just 2 years.
So in IIT, like you obviously have lot of different pictures in your mind as a student, and every different student, everyone is an IIT aspirant, and for 2 years, you are almost studying like 10, 12 hours or 14 hours in a single day. So you aspire that the college will be very transformational and it will be a very enriching experience and all those, which is obviously true. But eventually the first impression of it is not that way. Like when you enter the college, you see the, at least from an infrastructure perspective, you assume the college, because you have seen those type of colleges in movies and in other other episodes. So that imagination which you have while entering, that doesn't match with what exactly is out there. So definitely, in the first go, you don't get a very good impression after entering IIT but the curriculum of IIT has been designed in such a manner that it's not only focused on studies. I think because you have gone into IIT, it essentially is a valid enough proof that you had those skills to come into it, and then you are competing within the top 1% of the entire country. Like, you already had to be in top 1% to reach there, and within IIT now, if you have to compete there, you will have to be best among them. And best not only on studies front, on multiple fronts. Like, here there was weightage given to almost every extracurricular activities, whether it's debating, whether it's sports, whether it's actually going out to some competitions. Like there are multiple quizzing competitions, there is multiple drama activities which happen. So a lot of weightage was given to extracurricular sports apart from the studies, and it was a balance which everyone strived for, and multiple clubs and also a lot of elections. I would say I was involved a lot in elections as well in the college days. So a lot of elections which obviously open a new perspective to look at things from multiple arenas. And there also you have to be thinking, you have to be best from the entire ecosystem if you have to actually compete there. So definitely I would say that the 4 years at IIT, it was enriching for me in a way that it taught me a lot of leadership skills. I was a very shy kid in 12th. I usually used to speak with outsiders or any people whom I didn't know. But after that, it was primarily that I gained that perspective that you have to interact with new people, you have to learn new ideas. And it opens up a new perspective whenever you talk to any new people. And you should be obviously inclined towards gaining new ideas. And that learning curve should never stop. You should never assume in your lifetime that you know everything. And even there is a superiority complex multiple times that I am from IIT, so I will obviously have greater knowledge than any other local college student. But that is also not true. You should never show that, and we have seen that multiple times. Anyone can teach us, and you should be open to learning new things than being adamant on what you already know. So I think that entire process got evolved, and the entire leadership capabilities I got involved with entrepreneurship cell. Like, I was heading the entrepreneurship cell of IIT Delhi for 1.5 years. There we met all the founders. I met Snapdeal's founder, and who ultimately also ended up being the first investors in my venture. That was the first thing we invited them, and there it opened all new perspective in terms of how we can also run businesses. Being from a technology background, it is not very much obvious that how can any student or anyone from IITs directly go and venture into a business ecosystem, do a startup where you don't have any business expertise. Like, you primarily are being taught all the technical subjects. There are no business subjects as such.
So tell me something, like, after your after finishing IIT, you like kind of left the technical line and went into investment banking. So why did you not look at, doing something which is like a part of your core educational background?
That's a very interesting question. And I come up with this, a lot of times I am asked this question. So I did my engineering in, the major was in engineering physics. It is a very new branch, and it is only there in selective IITs. It's there in IIT Bombay, it's in IIT Delhi, and in IIT Guwahati. So it's only there in 4 to 5, where primarily the focus is on the basic concept of physics plus the engineering angle. There, majority of people who end up doing their bachelor's in engineering physics go to study for the MS or higher studies in terms of PhD to actually gain that expertise. Because in our curriculum at IIT, we were given a very holistic overview. We didn't went deep in any particular subject. Like, we studied quantum electronics, we studied physical mechanics, we studied the entire gravitational forces, but it was purely an overview which was given. So now we were essentially knowing everything from an outsider's perspective. There was no in-depth knowledge we get.
It was not like a job-focused kind of a specialization. Like, a lot of specializations are very job-focused. This was not the case here.
So this was not very job-focused. It was very analytical. There was computational physics. There were so many courses of mathematics. It was primarily improving your analytical capabilities, which are leveraged across the ecosystem in the banking roles. Like, in investment banking, it is purely a number of maths which you have to do. So essentially, engineering physics didn't have any core companies coming to the campus. So what people used to joke around, BlackRock is a core engineering physics job. Deutsche Bank, they have inclination towards people from physics. So all these investment banking companies, Goldman Sachs, who came to the campus, they had inclination towards hiring physics courses. And that was quite evident, because they knew that they have studied and gone through a rigorous analytical session in their 4 years. And what is they require also? They also require people with good analytical capabilities. So hence, these companies like BlackRock, Deutsche, Goldman Sachs, everything were called the core companies of physics.
So you spent just a year in Deutsche Bank. Was it because it was in Mumbai and you didn't want to be there, or, what was the reason?
So Deutsche, that was altogether a very new experience. Like, we straight away from a college into a proper corporate culture, and that too in an investment role. I had not studied anything from an investment standpoint. But that was a great learning curve, when I say I also took up my certifications like CFA alongside job, so as to get more deeper insights into the finance ecosystem there. And I could see the correlation between what I have been studying and what the application is there in terms of doing it while doing the job. So that was a great learning experience. But after 1 year, I could see that I am almost doing the same thing day in and day out. That the learning curve has flattened, and that was quite evident for me since last 2-3 months. I was just figuring out that I'm following the same routine, doing the same stuff, nothing new. I have studied. I obviously got a very good understanding in the first 6-7 months. I am now complementing that understanding with doing these certifications. So I'm learning a lot of new things while studying CFA. But from a job standpoint, it is pretty limited in its scope, or I'll have to spend at least 3-4 years more to switch to something else within the company. But in the young times, I think 3-4 years is a lot. it's actually a lot. Deutsche was on the sell side. I used to look at different folks that buy side is more attractive. You get to see different portfolios, and buy side is much more attractive than the sell side. So I was like, okay, let's try that also. Let's try the buy side of the things and not the sell side. Maybe sell side is completely giving me a different picture of the investment banking world. Maybe buy side is something different. And at that point,
so for our listeners who don't understand the investment banking jargons of buy side and sell side, can you demystify that?
Right. So essentially, there are two things in any banking ecosystem, in investment banking particularly. One are the buy side firms, one are the sell side firms. So buy side firms generally buy different stocks, buy different, take different positions in different portfolios. That suppose, to give an example, any mutual fund is generally a buy side player. They take bets.
So basically, people who are either doing wealth management or family office.
Right, family office, who are just investing in different portfolios, who are buying different things and managing the wealth on others' behalf. Sell side is just a typical bank, which is essentially managing that supply demand. That I want this, they'll manage it somehow. And they'll suppose I want a stock of a particular company. It is not listed. It's a private placement. So they will arrange those stocks from someone and sell it to the people who are buying it. And they are taking
basically sell side is people who facilitate the transaction.
Facilitate the transaction. Yes. In layman terms, they are facilitating the transactions. They are just bridging the gap between the suppliers and supply and the demand. And they are taking a cut on it. Like it is a purely commission on the transaction. So they are not assuming any risk themselves. All the banks, they are on the sell side. They cannot assume risk. They are just making the ends meet.
Hmm. And in BlackRock, what part of, they have so many different investments. So which part were you in? And, what was your mandate there? Like, what kind of investments were you looking at?
Yes. So I was part of the portfolio analytics team, where essentially we used to look at the portfolio positions, as in that suppose we have bought 10 stocks, then how the portfolio is performing in terms of the risk profile and to manage their, I think it will not, so there was a Sharpe ratio. Sharpe ratio is nothing but a ratio of what return you are getting versus the risk you have assumed. So here we used to closely monitor how the portfolios is performing, what are the different return profiles, risk profiles, how to change the positions in terms of which stock to sell, which to buy, at what point in time. It was primarily that, but I also got an exposure at that point in time. There were multiple distressed portfolios. So what is distressed portfolio? Anything which is essentially like a distressed portfolio, I would say that any loan which has gone bad, as in that I bought a bond. A bond is also a debt instrument. So just to explain what a bond is, suppose I'm giving anyone a loan. I have given 100 rupee loan to anyone. Now I'll be getting interest. Now if that guy defaults, it will turn into a bad loan, which essentially I paid him 100 rupees. I was expecting interest in return, but that guy defaulted. So even my principal has gone, but now there will be someone else, there will be a person B who will come to me, that he'll say that I'll buy that loan, I'll give you 50 rupees, 50% of that 100 rupees, but you'll get 50% of your principal, but you transfer the loan to me, I'll recover from that guy myself. So now this becomes a distressed loan, that which I sold it at 50% haircut to someone else, because I myself earlier thought it was an investment. So it was a typical debt investment which I did.
Basically, you cut your losses and matlab uska jitne mein bigya bech do types.
Exactly. Whatever haircut I can get. And now it is the mandate of that guy to actually recover from him. And I have just booked 50 rupees loss and I have got 50 rupees. At least it's better than 100 rupees loss.
So BlackRock does this here, distressed buying. They buy distressed assets.
Yes. They are into distressed portfolios also. So they buy distressed assets and then figuring out the price point. Also they buy distressed assets, as in that they figure out the price point. As I mentioned that I had 100 rupees portfolio and someone bought it for 50 rupees. What is the actual price point we need to buy that portfolio at? That analytics was done by us. That suppose someone had 100, someone had 100 rupees bad loan portfolio, what is the actual price I should buy it at? Like, what the amount I can extract? Suppose I am buying that 100 rupees portfolio, 10 rupees. And if I have to make anything out of it, I should at least be able to collect more than 10 rupees from the actual borrower. So there, for the unit economics to make sense, we used to calculate that what is the actual price, so that it is a win-win for both of us. Win-win for the person who is actually selling the distressed portfolio, and also as a company, we should be able to tell that this
is make profit.
Yes, so it is a win-win for both. So how to do that pricing? So some of our ARCs, who are the asset reconstruction companies, their typical job is to buy these distressed portfolios. So they also used to use the BlackRock platform to do all those analytics.
And how do you calculate the probability that, you know, that I will get, like, say I will recover 55 rupees, so I can pay 50 rupees for this? How do you calculate that? Okay, what is the likely recovery?
It's a purely a very intense data science models behind it, as in we refer to the previous data points only. In the similar type of portfolio in the past, basis demographics of the borrower, basics financials of the borrower, how that collections has happened, like what is the chance that it will get collected. So these are purely data science models which run. If we have the data, we'll be able to make a good estimate on the pricing. If we don't, obviously then it is a mere shot in the dark. But essentially everything when it comes to the numbers, and since these numbers are in it's a sizable number, as in that there's $100 billion portfolio being bought or a $1 billion portfolio being bought. So hence these numbers are big. So a lot of data science is involved while actually going ahead with buying those portfolios.
Okay. And because BlackRock had that data, that's why even ARCs would be coming to BlackRock for this.
Exactly. So they used to charge for their analytical platform, that you just use our platform, you pay us a software fee. So essentially they themselves had an investing arm. So BlackRock had two businesses. One was BlackRock Solutions, one was BlackRock Technology. So BlackRock Technology used to onboard these companies to do it, enabling them to do it. And there was a division of their own investment arm, which used to use the BlackRock platform to do it on their own as well. So there was a big Chinese wall in between, as in that they both cannot interact, because otherwise, obviously, there is a big conflict of interest.
Right. Okay. And this would be what kind of distress assets, like business loans or consumer loans or what, like, or all types?
Everything. Real estate, including real estate, used cars, bad debts as in mortgage loans, unsecured loans, business loans. And these were primarily in the US and the UK markets. So what we used to study, it was primarily in the US and the UK markets.
Okay, got it. So how did this lead to CreditGenics? Tell me about the birth of that idea. How was the idea born?
Right. So there, the NPA, I think that at that point in time was a buzzword. Everyone was reading about NPAs. Everyone was reading about how the economy is not performing well. The numbers are rising, bad loans are increasing. So the problem statement was quite evident. And even the ERCs were also in business. I think they used to buy these distressed portfolios at very cheap price, 1% of their portfolio value. So there, essentially, in 2019, like, I spent some years, one year, 8 months to 10 months in BlackRock. There, while I was venturing there, we could see in India a lot of fintechs, my colleagues, starting up in the lending ecosystem, trying to bridge that gap, which is quite evident, as in banks are not able to give loans in tier 2, tier 3 remote geographies because they didn't have any data points to underwrite. No CIBIL score, nothing, very limited accessibility. So the banks were not underwriting and giving loans to a lot of these people because of the risk profiles. So a lot of these fintechs started solving the underwriting part of the puzzle, as in giving them additional data points to underwrite using alternate data, making the process more seamless, providing a digital interface for anyone to actually come and take loans with a click of a button, with removing all those hassle of visiting, doing digital KYC. So a lot of fintechs were entering that area. But the collections, essentially, it is very easy to give out money and it is very difficult to take it back with interest. So if you see, lending is purely a collections business. Hence, we could see that a lot of intervention is there on the first part, But the later, which is essentially the collections, is still a very age-old playbook. No technological intervention, no prioritization of accounts, how to get the money, whom to target, with what strategy, with what communication, how to go about the entire part. It was purely a manual job which was being done across the ecosystem, whether it's a bank or a new age fintech or a old school NBFC. Like everyone was following the same criteria. Hence, we could see that now there's a lot of people entering the first part and solving the first part of the puzzle. Let's address the second part. And that also, I had some exposure from the BlackRock days, as in that I obviously priced portfolios on the distressed side, knew how the pricing actually happens, how it is bought, and what are the juice. So we could essentially see that in this collections business, if you're able to demonstrate that you are aiding any lender in improving their collections rate, as in giving them a delta over their existing money, you can easily charge them. You can easily charge them 20-25% of the extra value you're adding. So if suppose someone was collecting maybe 1 crore out of their bad loans portfolio, after us, if they're able to extract 1.5 crore, now for them it is a 50 lakh extra collection. And if you're charging them 20 lakhs, we can take 15 lakhs. They'll be more than happy to pay us, because for them it was essentially lost money which we have found. So it's a win-win, creating a win-win, and the return on investment, what we call ROI, is clear in this business.
So, okay, so this is, on paper, it sounds good, but then, you know, there are many, like there's a journey of evolution from an on paper good idea to executing it. Like, for example, did you decide to take an upfront SaaS-based payment, or did you decide to take a payment the way you explained just now, that whatever extra we help you collect, we take a percentage of it? Like, you know, how, from on paper to the evolution of execution, tell me about that journey.
Yes, I think that also is it's something you learn over the course of your journey. In the first, I think pricing is something which you really struggle with. And in the initial start, it was essentially not even pricing. It was essentially how to do this, how to solve this problem, how to create that extra value add. So that was a bigger question, that what should the platform look like? So to do that, what essentially we did earlier, we started working with very smaller fintechs and who were just coming up in 2019 through some of our references.
Exit from BlackRock. How did that happen? Like, when did you decide, okay, I have to quit BlackRock and do this full time?
So this happened in 2018 December. Essentially, I think at BlackRock also we were studying all these things. And at that point in time, I could see that I have now tried my sell side, I have tried the buy side, everything is good. But when I see myself 10 years down the line, can I imagine to be one of the VPs who are sitting there 38 years of age or 40 years of age doing the same thing over and over again? Like, is it exciting enough, or is it worth spending so much time here? I think that call was very clear. I have now explored the buy side, I've explored the sell side. It is something that I'll keep on switching. I'll never get satisfaction. And it is very important question you have to address now, whether you want to be a very small part of a very big ecosystem or a very big part of a very small organization.
And how did you meet your co-founders?
That was during the BlackRock days only. So I was obviously on a hunt to figure out a team who will be the best fit. Anand, who is my co-founder handling the tech part, he's my batchmate from IIT Delhi. He is a computer science grad, and he was working with 1MG since the college, after the college. So 1MG is also a healthcare startup and is solving the online medicine delivery problem. And there also the tech development started in 2014-15 when we were in college. So he was associated with them since those days. Like, he was working with them since 2014-15 and took that journey. So essentially, from my perspective, I knew that someone who has done that from a tech perspective and who is working with a startup, have the experience, will be the best here to lead the tech side. So that was very evident. It was primarily discussing it with him, and also then discussing the potential ideas, and then coming up together as a team. So we are three co-founders, and third one is Mayank, who is a lawyer and who comes from this side. not core collections, but essentially representing different governmental institutions before DRT, before debt redressing tribunals, helping different lenders in terms of actual core collections. So he brought in that legal expertise along with the collections part to address that problem. So it was primarily, we had a clear visibility around the roles and responsibilities. I was myself to brainstorm on entire sales, like to bring every client on board, handle the like the expectations part, and then discuss the, any investment potential opportunities. So I took under like my bucket the entire sales, business development, investment, and other parts, where clear mandate of Anand was to scale the product, build it from an engineering standpoint, also the product role. And Mayank was on the operation side and actually assisting also the tech development, as in by his inputs in terms of how it should be done.
How did you figure out the technology solution? Like, you know, how did you figure out ke ye banane ki zarurat hai to improve efficiency?
Yes, yes. I think that was also something which we understood after we took up actually the collections mandate. So as I mentioned that after quitting, what we did, we started working with smaller fintechs to solve their collections puzzle. Okay, yeah, you are also essentially figuring out things, right? You are solving the underwriting part. You can outsource the collections to us. We'll brainstorm it for you. We'll figure out how it gets done. We'll also, all you obviously have inputs, but you essentially can get it done through us. So we actually took collections mandate that we'll get it collected. Not there was no software platform then. We understood the process. We did the same process over Excel. We engaged different lawyers. We engaged different collection agencies on ground to actually do that collections part, take that mandate. The entire dealing part was being done by us. And for the upcoming fintechs, that reduced their workload, that they didn't have to deal with the collection agencies. It was primarily we who were on their behalf doing all those collections and trying to do it. Understanding, learning, and figuring out how those collection agencies work, how the typical debt collection process happens. Then understood, did some surveys, took a look at all the new upcoming fintechs, how are they addressing collections. They then took up some collections mandate in an established fintech to actually on a percentage resolution basis, so that they will set their expectations right on right up front. Like they will be straight in our face if you're not performing. Then we did that activities for 6-7 months. We got enough data points. We understood the entire process in and out. And there we started building the product in July 2019. That was a starting point. We started building the product after the brainstorming in July 2019. That was a start. We started brainstorming on what product should be built.
And when did you raise your angel? Like you, I think you did an angel round first, no? Before the current...
Yes, right. So in July 2019, we started even working on the platform development. In 2 months, we came up with a very small MVP with some wireframes, some designing aspect. At that point in time, it was primarily we engaged certain developers. We invested our own capital. We invested roughly 20-25 lakhs of our capital in the initial 6-7 months and 8 months. Hired some folks, interns. After that point in time, it somewhat appeared that at least I should try, because of my entrepreneurship club network, I knew a lot of people, and I just tried, let's explore this ecosystem, because if we are able to at least get maybe 1.5 to 2 CR, we'll get sufficient bandwidth to hire certain folks, get this product rolled out, and establish a product market fit, whether to figure out its need or not. So at that point in time, after 2 months only, I interacted with Kunal. I wrote him a mail and got connected with him. And since we had a lot of common network, it was not very difficult for me to reach out to him. I reached out to him. He candidly called us in his office, both Rohit and Kunal. There was a one-hour discussion which happened with Rohit. He was understanding what we are doing, how exactly we plan to address it, and stuff. So it was a one-hour conversation with him. And there, after that 1 hour conversation, he mentioned that Kunal also will speak to you and wants to speak to you regarding your idea, because it sounded interesting to us. So we have scheduled the conversation one after the other, and we want to get you understand the entire ecosystem. So Kunal then came in. As soon as Rohit left, Kunal came in, and his meeting was scheduled. His call was it was an in-person meeting. It was not the COVID era. So his in-person meeting was scheduled for 1 hour, but But it went on for 1.5 hours. He kept on getting calls ki aapko sir meeting mein aana hai, you should come here. There was some other guy in person who came ki you are called in other meeting. He mentioned ki please postpone it, I'll come after half an hour later. He was also so much engaged in the discussion. It was essentially like we didn't obviously it was very difficult for us to figure out that time has gone and it is already 1.5 hours since we are in this discussion room. There it was a very, very candid discussion that what challenges we are facing, how we came up with this idea, what we are doing, what are the plans, how to price. We were early for a lot of answers and we were very upfront about it that you are asking me this question. I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I'll figure it out. I'll tell you what we know, but whatever we actually don't know, we'll be very upfront and categorically mentioning that we'll figure that out. But it is a very good question. We have taken note of it and we'll figure that out. Obviously, you are speaking from us so many years of experience. So whatever you are telling us is something which we learn. But essentially, it's good that you have told us. Now we'll be very careful in addressing this question. So there are a lot of things, a lot of questions went answered well, were not answered. And at the end of the conversation, he mentioned, see, leave aside everything. Abhi kitna paisa chahiye? How much amount do you want? Because I think it is worth spending your time on since you all have left your high coveted jobs. I feel now it is a good idea to actually spend time on. So I am definitely with you on that. Let me know what you are thinking around how much, what money you require, etc., etc. Then it was very simple conversation. We mentioned him that this is the very clear 1 year, it's a 1 year runway we are looking for, and this is how the calculation looks like. This is how much we require. Then he mentioned, okay, let's do it, and I'll give you my offer tomorrow after discussion with Rohit. And the next day in the morning, I think the offer came and it got closed into 2 to 3 days.
Wow. And how much did you raise in that angel round?
So it was not only Kunal. We brought in some relevant people from the different industries through the same network. So it was led by Kunal and Rohit. So it was almost a 2 CR fundraise. It was a 2 crore raise where 1 crore was by Rohit and Kunal and the remaining 1 crore was by other angel investors who had some name in the fintech industry or the software industry, SaaS industry.
Kunal Shah also came in that round only?
Kunal Shah came later. Kunal Shah came later.
Okay. So,
it was essentially the first believers were Kunal, Behel and Rohit.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. So from that period, how did the journey evolve after that? Like once the funds came in, then how did the trajectory change? And, you know, tell me about the post the angel funding.
Yes. So Angel, it actually gave us now, it was an actual company, right? After that, we were able to hire people. We took up an office space because before that, I used to live in Gurgaon, like while I was doing a job, and our entire ground floor was converted into the office. So we were used to living at first floor and the entire ground floor was converted into an office space. So there was no proper office space before that race. Then we took up an office space, we hired people, we started co-development of the product. We started and we built a first version of the product in January 2020, in the 4 months. But it was a very basic product though. It was a very basic CRM type of product. But we launched the first version in January 2020 using that capital. We hired some core developers, we hired some interns, and it was a full-fledged office. We used to go, it established a routine that instead of just switching from first floor to ground floor, now we are actually essentially going to an office and doing that thing. In January 2020, we launched the same clients where we took up collection mandates, these smaller fintechs. We essentially rolled this product out for free to them. Ki aap test karo, aap batao kya hai isme, what exactly is required, what is not required, what is good, what is bad. They were the first adopters. It was a very clear indicator that they will be the first adopters and they will give us a very good relevant input. So there is no point charging them for that, because otherwise then it will not be impacting our adoption rate. So those were the same fintechs we worked with in the initial 6 months to enable collections, to also help onboard on the platform and then give their input. So in the first 3 months, we were working with those fintechs only, and then this COVID scenario happened, which was out of the blue. Like, no one had anticipated that this thing will happen.
So one question I have here before the COVID. So essentially, the first platform would have been like, you understood ke collections mein kya workflows hain, and then you build a platform to digitize the workflows so that everyone knows ke kisko kya karna hai next, and everyone has visibility through dashboards and analytics. Like that would have been what you built, right?
Right. That was something which we actually built, that just to give a visibility around, it is purely a visibility around different teams, how the different teams have been working, and giving them a seamless information flow, which was essentially missing. Like, there are multiple teams involved in collection. There's a calling team, there's a communications team, there's a legal team, there's a field team, and everyone was operating in their own silos. They were following the same cases without any feedback loop. And there was no priority order whom to target first, whether it should only be the calling team who should follow up on that cases, whether this is a very easy to collect case where essentially I don't even need to involve any manual resources. Eventually, even the communications will work best.
And you would have automated the communication also, like SMS and
SMS, email, right. We did this automation, but that also happened in phases. Like, initially, we just gave them a CRM. It's a collections management platform. Kya clone upload kar do. You can trigger manually SMSs, emails. You can get a visibility. But this automation pieces came in later. So the first version had only a simple plain CRM tool functionality, where you can trigger SMSs, you can trigger emails, you can do calling, you can see how the legal is performing. But it was a purely it's a management tool, no intelligence tool. Yeah, so got a lot of inputs during that phase. And then I think for 3 months, we saw that there are 6 fintechs who are using it now. And they're using it very well, as in that their time spent on platform was on the higher side. So we essentially knew that they're using it. After that phase, the COVID thing happened, which was out of the blue. We were not sure how to react to this. Like, we were completely clueless how to react to this, whether it will be a good thing for us or a bad thing for us. We were not sure. But essentially, we shut down the office. We made it work from home. And after that, eventually in 4 days time, RBI came up that we are implementing moratorium, which essentially meant that any collection activity will not happen for the next 3 months. Who wants to pay will pay. Who wants to pay will pay. There'll be no collections as such communications which will be sent. Now, upfront we took ke chalo ab hamara to matlab it is essentially that we are out of business for next 3 months. There's no utility of the platform as of now. Like, we essentially not be able to sell it to anyone. So we thought that, but we essentially also figured out that this problem will become severe after this. This bad loans problem will become very severe after this. The reason being that 3 months is a good enough time for people to forget about their EMI payments. And also the job scenario and other things are not looking in a good shape. So the collections will become a much bigger problem after the pandemic. And there it might increase our adoption rate. Might. There was a big might, obviously, in front of that. That might increase. But as of now, it is a zero revenue phase for us going forward for the 3 months. But we also felt now we have enough inputs to work upon. Like, our product team will work upon all the inputs. And meanwhile, our sales team, operations were zero. Our sales team and me alongside others will purely focus on how to devise a strategy to reach out to the relevant stakeholders in the banking ecosystem, in the different NBFCs. We'll trigger some emails, cold emails. We'll do a proper campaign activity essentially to just let people know that we are there once the moratorium is lifted. People should get to know at least we exist. Like, just to showcase that existence, we started working on some PR stuff, writing down articles on Medium, on Quora, and doing all those things, which to just get some popularity in the market so that people are essentially aware about us. And meanwhile, the product was at core focus. In May, we could see that we got a lot of attraction. There was so much response on our cold emails. Like, there was 8% revert back rate on our cold emails. Out of every 100 mails shooted out, 8 people replied to that.
Mm-hmm. And these were all like either banking collection managers or fintech collection people.
fintech guys, these guys from the lending NBFCs, mostly those guys. Like, it was primarily fintech lenders, risk heads, founders, banks obviously don't reply to cold emails. So bank is something, it's a completely different ballpark game to crack them.
Do you also target collection agencies? Like, there are these on ground agencies. Does your software, like, do you also sell to them?
It is a use case for them, but essentially it's sophisticated enough as of now, I think, to onboard them, and that market is very fragmented for us to even drive any unit economics out of them. So we have not focused as of now to sell to any collection agencies because of even the paying capacity we know, and even the appreciation of the platform, how to use it, we could see that will be very less in that sector. So we targeted the lenders, fintechs, NBFCs during that phase, and we could see a good response, inbound response to our emails, to our cold emails. And there, essentially, we started showcasing the demos. Like, it was purely Zoom demos which were conducted. And there got a lot of inputs. Isko aise kar do, you can do this, you can add this, this is a pain point. Everyone gave the inputs because essentially now everyone, there was a clear mandate to scale up their tech infrastructure to handle those volume collections. Earlier, it was a good to have product. It was not in the must have category. It was good to have because they were essentially managing it. During that time, the new disbursement was stopped. There was no new lending which was going on because of the market scenario. Now, there is a clear mandate that once the moratorium is lifted, there will be huge collections problem. So all the sales people were moved to collections. Everyone in the sales team was moved to collections.
And they needed the infrastructure to manage so many people.
It was just a temporary way to handle, because you can increase the number of people that will essentially help you scale the collections. But that is also not a scalable manner to do it. It was just a temporary way around. So in May, we were expecting that now the moratorium will be lifted. It got again extended by 6 months, 3 months. That came as a shocker to us as well, because now we had to sustain. We had to sustain because essentially it meant another 3 months zero revenue.
And did you have runway?
We had 1 year runway. We had 1 year runway. We had 1 year runway, and we managed to get that runway going. Because we essentially also knew that it is a very unpredictable situation, and even Kunal was very useful and guided us that you should be in a position to deliver the product after this is over. So you should save as much as you can at this point in time. You should not be spending anything extra apart from what you need. Because it should not be a scenario that once this problem is over and your collection product is required by the market, you don't have bandwidth to build it. And you don't have funds to do that. So there, and obviously the funding scenario was also not good. Like, there was no funds being, no investor funding anything. It was such an unpredictable situation, and it was a purely funding was dried. So eventually, even to understand that, even to go out and look for funding was something which we were not doing, because we knew that this is something which is not doable. But interestingly, what happened for the investors as well, the entire hospitality space, travel space, everything which was badly impacted by COVID were not of interest. They didn't have the leverage to park their money or invest in those sectors. So 70% of the sectors where investors used to invest were gone bad due to COVID. Now, it was essentially only 30% of sectors which were neutral or which got positively impacted by COVID, which might be healthcare, which might be edtech, it might be Zooming platforms like Zoom, any fintech who is there in terms of essentially engaging the payments. So there were some sectors particularly which got positively impacted, and ours was also the one which seemingly looked like will get positively impacted after the moratorium is over, because the collections will become a much bigger problem there. Though it appeared that once this problem is actually come over, then our platform will be of very good utility. So we were also focusing on that marketing and all those activities. So by a matter of chance, our one article got picked by Our Story. Purely organically, it got picked by Our Story, that how we are essentially targeting to aiming to help NBFC lenders to get the collections done, etc., etc.
So, what do you mean your article got picked? Like, did you send it to your story or did you publish it on a Quora and they...
It was published on a Medium. It was published on Medium. It was shared through our LinkedIn channels. It was shared through my personal LinkedIn. So it got picked up from there. So it got picked up from there and it got published. And there we saw a lot of inbound interest from a lot of investors. They started reaching out. Sequoia, Excel, Lightspeed. Everyone started reaching out to understand what we are doing, how we are doing this, a background, etc., etc. So everything started on June 17th. I even remember the date when we got the first ping. It was June 17th I got the first message, and then it was a series of these messages which came in on my LinkedIn to understand. Then in June 17th had first interaction. On June 29th, we got our term sheet from Axel, from Sequoia, from three funds.
Wow. Okay. So why did you choose Axel? I think you didn't go with Sequoia, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think that is also something which was a tough choice to make. But Axel, at that point in time, we felt that Axel will be potentially a good fit because of their SaaS expertise. Sequoia came in with the financial services expertise. But it was essentially they do a lot of background checks on us also before investing. After the offers, we did some background checks on them also. So, with multiple founders where both of them are investors. So there we felt maybe from our particular use case, Sequoia is also a very good fund, but from our use case, Excel might be better. And also Excel was the first mover, as in they were the first one to extend an offer. So there was definitely some soft corner for that as well. So essentially we went ahead with Excel during that race.
Okay. So then tell me what happened after the moratorium got lifted.
Yes. I think so Excel was very helpful after the even in that phase. They invested in July 2. They signed the term sheet. It took 2 months DD also, which happens. And then we got the funds in around September at the time when the moratorium was getting lifted.
How much did they invest?
They invested 3 million and... but the overall round was a 3.5. So rest $500,000 were invested from other angels. Some funds like DMI, they have an alternate fund. So there were some strategic angels like Kunal Shah also invested during that round only.
Like Kunal Shah, was that inbound or you reached out to him?
So to them, it was primarily, I think, whenever a round gets completed by any typical venture capital firm, in their own circle, they also circulate that. So they circulate that, whosoever is interested, they directly reach out to the founders. And then we obviously had a list that who will be helpful for us and who will not. From a strategic point of view, we had options of around 25 to 30 people whom we thought will be strategic. And then out of that, we took money from 8 or 10 people. So Kunal Shah also was strategic in a way that their main business model was turning out to be lending. They planned to venture into the lending where collections was also something where they wanted to invest. And hence, instead of developing their own capabilities, spending so much time doing the same thing which we have done, they essentially thought it is best to partner. And also Kunal Shah at that point in time was very candid in saying that you test out any new product line on us. You have enough legroom for you to try out any tech piece you want to do. And also we'll give our inputs in terms of how to build it for a credit card company. So from an investment standpoint, from a business standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, it was a win-win for everyone. So we got him on board. So after the moratorium, I think so the exciting journey started after the moratorium. There this problem, as we were expecting, it exploded. It was a huge explosion in terms of the problem which happened. We saw so much demand in terms of the platform that we essentially were not even able to cater to some of the requests. So we had to stop outbound sales for some time. we had to stop outbound sales for some time. It was only inside sales. It was only the people who were reaching out to us. We were entertaining them. And the banks whom we were reaching out before COVID started reaching out to us that we want this, we want to have a look at the platform, demo, etc., etc. Although with any bank, it is at least 20 meetings you have to do with different stakeholders, different people, convincing everyone, doing their security audits to get a final nod. Then the pricing, they are very hard negotiators. Pricing, everything you have to do, get it done. But the banks were the toughest. But even before the banks, all these NBFCs, new age NBFCs like Udaan, LoanTap, MoneyTap, MoneyView, n number of fintechs which are there, all these got onboarded. And we went on from almost zero revenue. The revenue was zero for 6 months. We went on from zero revenue to almost doing 1.4 CR a month in January.
Wow. Amazing. Okay.
And that too without even multi-banks going live. It was only one bank which went live during that time. So even without banks going live, we were able to go to that revenue scale. And there also in January, we reported a profit and EBITDA of around 42% net profit after taxes for that month. So during that time, it became clear that there's a clear path towards getting live with everyone and like getting this rolling, and we have enough capital in the bank to roll it out to the Indian ecosystem. But in that January month only, we started getting some queries from across India, like across different borders. Like there was a query from Indonesia bank, there was a query from a bank based out of Vietnam, Southeast Asian countries, to understand what we are doing, how we are doing it, getting the processes. So we figured out that this problem statement is common across the developing economies. Collections is a much bigger problem in other Southeast Asian countries because they don't even have an e-NASH or an e-mandate system. To explain what e-NASH e-mandate is, it's an auto-debit that you automatically, your amount gets debited without even your consent, you get a sign in e-NASH. So a lot of the collections problem in India got solved because automatically the payment gets debited if your money is there in the account. That e-NASH e-mandate is not there in other countries, so collections is a much bigger problem there. So now our focus was to get going very aggressive since we knew that this market will be very hot for the next 2 years and we have to capture as much as we can. There we started receiving a lot of inbound interest from the same funds we spoke to in the last time, from new funds. Even Sequoia again reached out to figure out whether there is an investment potential there, opportunity there as of now or not. So that was something that we were in a commanding position because we didn't require any funds. It was essentially, and I also have heard that the best time to raise is when you are not raising, and with investors I have given, you don't need it. And with the investors also I figured out that like they're very good. Like if you ask for money from them, they'll probably give you advice. If you ask for advice, they are probably interested in giving you the money, because on and that is a very true fact, because they only I think try to invest when they see everything is going very well. As in that whenever anyone used to interact with me, I used to say, "Yeah, nahi chahiye, abhi to paisa nahi chahiye, sab sahi chal raha hai. We are doing very well. We have reported net profit. We have a strong client pipeline. We are good. We have very aggressive plans. We'll reach this revenue run rate in so much time. And it's going very well for us." And then obviously they are also on lookout for such businesses which are running very smoothly, and there's a clear pathway and clear runway to execute the different things. So essentially, if they figure out that everything is going very smoothly and they don't require funds, it's the best time to invest for them as well. So during that, got a multiple interest, but we were very clear that if we have to raise now, it will be at our terms. So we can ask for any valuation or any terms we want. If it happens, it happens. Otherwise, it is not going to happen. It's okay. It's fine either ways. So there we ended up getting a very strategic investor on board. So that will be also made public in very soon. It has been covered although by some channels. But yeah, so we onboarded Westbridge Capital, Westbridge is a very heavy investor in financial services domain. They are on cap table of almost 30-35 NBFCs and banks. Deep investors in the financial ecosystem, in the lending ecosystem. They are also investors in CIBIL. They are on the cap table of Experian. Multiple, like they are on cap tables of multiple of these financial institutions. So there we could see that from a like synergy perspective, we could easily see that they'll be able to reduce our GTM as in go-to-market in multiple of these NBFCs. And also they are very good in terms of their track record, as in they are managing $6.5 billion of fund in India. So the fund, as of now, the quantum is around 23 to 24 million. And it is at over 100 million valuation. It is around 110.
Wow, amazing. So that's like phenomenal value creation in like a matter of months that you have achieved.
Yeah, amazing. So we raised at almost at 6x in 6 months. So, and we gave exit to some of the investors who were in the angel round invested.
Okay, amazing. So, do you think right now you're able to capture a large part of the margin because this is not a commodity software, you know? So you can tell a bank, I am helping you recover 50 lakhs more, so give me 20 lakhs out of that. But eventually this could become commoditized, no? As people see the opportunity and then, you know, more companies will pile on, create similar tools. And so what do you think will be your moat, and, you know, how will you protect your margins?
It's a very interesting question. It's a very good question. I think I come across this question by every investor. here, what we could see as of now also, Akshay, that it's a valid question. I think anyone can come up with it. But the data we are capturing, we know at a pin code level how the collection is doing. We keep on sending newsletters. We have our models are built, our data ML models are built in a way to prioritize the counts. At what pin code you need to prioritize, how the collection is going on for this particular type of borrower. Now, any new portfolio we onboard, we exactly know the contours of that portfolio. Like suppose there's a two-wheeler portfolio based out of Rajasthan. We'll essentially tell ke dekho Rajasthan mein two-wheeler portfolio ki performance across the ecosystem SEA. So you should expect the similar numbers, and this is the strategy which is working best in this geography at this point in time, at this pin code, and this is how you should go about it. So that data we are sitting on is the moat. It is essentially that we are leveraging that data capabilities. And anyone who comes in the market at this point in time, will have to build that data by themselves. And there is no reason for any bank or any fintech to go to them. Either like they have to be 10x better than us, because as of now, they have gone from a no software approach to a software. Any new software to replace us, they have to be 10x better than us. Only selling it for lesser will not be sufficient. And they cannot never compete us within the pricing. Like if any new even startup comes up, it's really a chance that they will be aggressively funded in the initial times. So we will have enough capital to ultimately, even if there is a pricing war, we can do that. But that is should not be the scenario, because it's essentially the value add. It's not only commodity pricing we are doing. If we are able to drive those value add by a combination of our data, by a combination of multiple things, then it makes sense for them to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how old are you, Rishabh?
Akshay, I'm 26.
So how does it feel? At 26, you are probably worth at least, you know, like maybe 50 to 100 times more than what your parents would be worth. And, you know, so how does it feel to be where you are today?
I think I never compare myself with my parents, though, because I think everything is there because of them. Like,
not to say that you will compare, but I mean, it's like compared to anyone in your social circle, you would be worth 50 to 100 times of anyone that you would have grown up with, anyone you would have spent time with. You know, you would be worth more than 99% of them, and you would be worth 50 to 100 times more. So, you know, how does it feel being Rishabh Goyal today? That's what I want to know.
You know, I think, yeah, actually, so there it obviously feels good in a way that essentially our labor or hard work has paid So it essentially it's a journey of ups and downs where we also think that there might be a scenario you'll have to shut down again, go back to the same world, again do the same thing. But it is essentially here, like having found out that I don't actually, at this point in time, I don't feel tired at any point in time, even on weekdays, even on weekends. We are working on Sundays, we're doing office stuff, we are doing calls, we are taking all the calls on Sundays. And it also doesn't tire us, which essentially means that we are doing something and we can see a value add is being done and it's some value creation we are doing. So these monetary stuff is something which comes on its own. It is something which comes along, but that is not the core objective to get it done. But talking to everyone, I think I, as of now also, my social circle is same, everything is same. There's not even an iota of a difference in what I used to be before or as of now. And I think humbleness is the key to eventually go there. You have to just keep your heads down and execute. Whenever you lose your touch with the ground reality, whenever you actually lose that humbleness, where the downfall starts. And that is something which I have seen across my journey, which I have seen that how eventually the downfall starts once you lose your ground touch and once you lose that humbleness, okay, my wealth has become this much, etc., etc., and then I need to improve my social circle, etc. So all these things should not bother you. You should be in the same. And I think what I can see as my strength is I come from a middle class family. So I don't have that luxurious, I don't have that kind of aspirations that I have to go to this or I have to wear this type of clothes. So I think that is our biggest strength also. Like we are never dependent on any luxurious lifestyle. So eventually I don't want also to go into that manner. It is essentially that is our biggest strength that we don't need, like Ambani and Adani, they have to maintain their standard of living. They have to actually go and spend a lot. We don't need to do it. Like that is our biggest strength. We come from a middle class family and we don't need to do that things.
So how much of the success that Credgenix and you have achieved do you attribute to luck? How important was luck in it? Or
yeah, definitely luck is a very important factor also. I cannot attribute a certain percentage. It is a combination. It is as in a combination of your hard work. It is a combination of an opportunity, the tailwinds, the scenario, the luck. Eventually, everything, if it fits in the right spot, it is the right spot. Any of the thing falls apart, you are done. So you should not worry about the things which are not in your control, not your own hand. Like even during the fundraise, it was primarily, I think we were discussing if something, there are obviously a lot of questions which bother us, but if they are not in our hands, we should not just unnecessarily worry about them. Like you should do best what is within your control. Like what is not in your control, you should just definitely leave it to, if there is a supreme power, you leave it to them and see what exactly it happens. You should not worry about things which are not in your hands. So my objective is to give my 100% and then leave it. Then don't worry about it. Like whatever is bound to happen will happen. Like if that is something is not in our control, we should not worry about it. Somehow I feel that here luck was important in a way that this COVID helped us a lot because it increased the adoption of digitization. It is somewhat of a scenario which no one had anticipated. We were not sure whether it will impact us in a positive manner or negative manner, but it turned out to be helpful for us. Like same thing happened for Paytm, demonetization turned out to a very big boom. So what we felt that maybe our adoption of the platform was not at that scale if it would have been pre-COVID.
So that was Rishabh's inspiring story of building up a $100 million SaaS company with nothing more than grit and hustle. And we hope it inspires you to find that niche and build your startup.
You like the Founder Thesis podcast? Then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.